This is the first day of this August 2011 two-day Sesshin. And I'd like to start by saying something about the stick. There are many people who misconstrue, really, the meaning of the stick. And this can go on for years and years. And if one does not really see or understand what it's about, then it's actually kind of a negative thing. So I'd like to say this one thing about the stick. There are many reasons it's used, some to raise energy, etc. But here's what I think is the main thing. When the warning tap, when the stick is placed on your shoulder for the warning tap, your body mind immediately withdraws itself from thoughts in preparation for the stick. You don't really have to do this on purpose. This is what the stick does. So there you are for a moment, ready, as in the sense of ready, get set, go, that kind of ready. In that ready, you're obliged not to have thoughts because you'd miss the starting gun. This state, a short state of readiness, is, we could say, that's a window into reality, except that there's no window because there's no duality. It is reality. Brief, over time, this has a lot of value. It helps to train us in Zen. The stick is Zen training, pulling ourselves out of thought, being ready. This is it. So don't fail to appreciate that. Now, on the one hand, if the stick is used too lightly, you maybe just could go on with your thoughts, if you happen to be in thoughts at that time. And if the stick is used too heavily, you would get some anticipatory anxieties, and thoughts would be coming up about how much it was going to hurt, etc. So it's incumbent on the monitors to use the stick in a way that is beneficial to you, not too light and not too heavy. You need to give the monitors guidance if it's not working for you. You need to write a note, say it needs to be a little stronger or don't hit me so hard. But the best thing is not to simply, out of a dislike for the stick, reject it. You're rejecting a part of Zen training. You're rejecting a window into readiness, into reality. So what I want to say is give it a real try. Ultimately, if there's something in your past, and for some people, they've been beaten as children or something like this, a lot of corporeal punishment, the stick is something that maybe is not useful. But over time, most people will see its value. So it's been around for more than 1,000 years and probably wouldn't have survived that long if practitioners and teachers didn't see it to be of real value. So I'm going to get into some fairly heavy topics about demons and phobias. So I decided to start out reading something kind of light. Just some people will have recognized this article I'm going to read from, and others will not. And it gives a basis for affirming your faith in this practice. This was just a week ago. Scott posted it on the bulletin board in the Rochester Center. It says, research shows how meditation can physically change the brain. A quiet explosion of new research indicating that meditation can physically change the brain in astonishing ways has started to push into mainstream. Several studies suggest that these changes through meditation can make you happier, less stressed, even nicer to other people. It can help you control your eating habits and even reduce chronic pain, all the while without taking prescription medication. Meditation is an intimate and intense exercise that can be done solo or in a group. And one study showed that 20 million Americans say they practice meditation. It has been used to help treat addictions, to clear psoriasis, and even to treat men with impotence. The U.S. Marines are testing meditation to... I don't know about this, but anyway, they're testing meditation to see if it makes more focused, effective warriors. And if you're going to be a warrior, you might as well be a focused, effective warrior. Corporate executives at Google, General Mills, Target, and Aetna Insurance, as well as students in some of the nation's classrooms, have used meditation. Various celebrities are also known meditators, but I'm not going to read that list of celebrities because it might take us off somewhere else. In one study, a research team from Massachusetts General Hospital looked at the brain scans of 16 people before and after they participated in an 8-week course in mindfulness meditation. The study, published in the January issue of Psychiatry Research, this is the title of it, Neuroimaging, concluded that after completing the course, parts of the participants' brains associated with compassion and self-awareness grew, and parts associated with stress shrank. Recently, the Dalai Lama, this isn't so recent really, but the Dalai Lama granted permission for his monks, who are master meditators, to have their brains studied at the University of Wisconsin, one of the most high-tech brain labs in the world. Richard Davison, a PhD at the university, and his colleagues led the study, and they said they were amazed by what they found in the monks' brain activity readouts. During meditation, encephalogram patterns increased and remained higher than in the initial baseline taken from a non-meditation state. But you don't have to be a monk to benefit from meditation, which is now gaining acceptance in the field of medicine. Physicians have increasingly started prescribing meditation instead of pills to benefit their patients. A Harvard Medical School report released in May found that more than 6 million Americans had been recommended meditation and other mind-body therapies by conventional healthcare providers. So there's a question, of course, of how long these people continued on their own. Perhaps the most mind-bending potential benefit of meditation is that it will actually make practitioners nicer. Chuck Raisin, a professor at Emory University, conducted a meditation study in which he hooked up microphones to participants who had been taught basic meditation and those who hadn't. He then recorded them at random over a period of time. Raisin found that these newly trained meditators used less harsh language than people who had no meditation experience. They were more empathetic with people, Raisin said. They were spending more time with other people. They laughed more, you know, all those things. They didn't use the word I as much. They used the word we more. However, and here a bit of reality here, however, even the Dalai Lama admitted that meditation is not the silver bullet cure-all for every ailment or emotion. He said, occasionally, lose my temper. If someone is never lose temper, then perhaps that may come from outer space. real strength. The Dalai Lama also cautioned that meditation takes patience, so new meditators should not expect immediate results. The Dalai Lama said, "The enlightenment not depend on rank," he said laughing, "it depends on practice." Some scientists believe that in a generation, Americans will see meditation as being essential to maintaining a healthy lifestyle, as diet as essential to maintaining a healthy lifestyle as diet and exercise. The difference between non-religious mindfulness meditation is one of, it's on a kind of a continuum, but Zen meditation ultimately strives for getting rid of self-centeredness. And to do that, you have to go very far, very deeply into this practice. But that's what makes it a religious practice. This unwinding or undoing of our self-centeredness. Now, I want to get into demons and to do this, I'm going to read an article very recently in the New York Times called "Learning to Cope with the Mind's Taunting Voices." And goes, "Living with Voices." Joel Holt, a computer consultant and entrepreneur who has a diagnosis of schizophrenia, describes how he's learned to manage the voices in his head. That's under a picture of him. The job was Lee's Summit, Missouri. The job was gone, the gun was loaded, and a voice was saying, "You're a waste. Give it up now. Do it now." It was a command, not a suggestion. And what mattered at that moment, a winter evening in 2000, was not where the voice was coming from, but how assured it was, how persuasive. Losing his first decent job ever seemed like too much for Joe Holt to live with. It was time. "All I remember then is a knock on the bedroom door and my wife Patsy. She sits down on the bed and hugs me. And I'm holding the gun in my left hand down here out of sight," said Mr. Holt, 50, a computer consultant and entrepreneur who has a diagnosis of schizophrenia. She says, "Joe, I know you feel like quitting, but what if tomorrow is the day you get what you want?" And she walks out. I sat there staring at the gun for an hour at least, and finally decided, never again. It can never be an option. Patsy deserves for me to be trying. In recent years, researchers have begun talking about mental health care in the same way addictions specialists speak of recovery, the lifelong journey of self-treatment and discipline that guides substance abuse programs. The idea remains controversial. Managing a severe mental illness is more complicated than simply avoiding certain behaviors. The journey has more mazes, fewer road signs. Yet people like Joel Holt are traveling it and succeeding. Most rely on some medical help, but each has had to build core skills from the ground up through trial and repeated error. Now more and more of them are risking exposure to tell their stories publicly. If you're going to focus on recovery, you might want to ask those who've actually recovered what it is that they're doing," said Frederick Fries III, an associate professor of psychiatry at Northeastern Ohio University's College of Medicine, who has written about his own struggles with schizophrenia. Certainly traditional medicine has not worked very well for many of us, Dr. Fries went on. That's why we've had to learn so many survival tricks on our own. First among Mr. Holt's many resources is his wife, who has been an effective at-home therapist, in part, paradoxically, because she does not consider mental illness an adequate excuse to shirk responsibilities. I won't go through Joe's whole history here, but he was incredibly abused as a child and became an orphan at three, and then was sent to an orphanage somewhere in Alabama, Cullman, Alabama, where there was a lot of real mistreatment, regular beatings with a board and ping pong paddle and sometimes a razor strap. You had to memorize a portion of the Bible, and if you didn't, you'd get a beating. This guy had a really, really rough childhood. So by the time he was 21, he attempted suicide. At 21, after a suicide attempt with whiskey and pills landed him in the hospital, he finally got a diagnosis of schizophrenia. He dismissed it. Pure junk is what I thought at the time, Mr. Holt said. Yes, he felt that people were always looking at him strangely, judging him, and more frightening, saying terrible things to him, savage insults that they then denied having made. But was that a mental illness or the effect of a cruel childhood? I was broken, he said. I just thought, well, I'm a weirdo. I'll never be normal. He could never be sure, no matter what trouble he found, no matter what the doctors diagnosed, no matter how voraciously he read about brain development, he would always have alternative explanations for his predicament. The abandonment, the beatings, the lack of any family attachments. Until the mid-1990s, I was consumed with that question, he said. Am I mentally ill or environmentally damaged? He caught the first glimpse of an answer one afternoon in 1996 when his boss invited him out to lunch. He was anxious, expecting bad news. Now married, he was providing for Patsy, a teenage stepson, and three foster children the couple were planning to adopt. Working at a health clinic in Kansas City, he needed more income and job security, not less. And that is what he got at lunch, a promotion. We were having a great time, laughing and celebrating, and at the end, my boss says she's going to the ladies' room, he said. But just before she leaves, I hear her say something awful, just terrible. She insults me loudly. He stood there by the door, stung and confused, until she returned. The jab made no sense, giving the spirit of the occasion, but it was still ringing in his ears. By the way, did you hear someone say, he asked, repeating the insult. She was dumbfounded. So was he, doing his best to pretend he was joking. By the time he climbed back into his car, he was short of breath. Could it be that all those nasty remarks over the years, those biting insults from out of nowhere, did not exist, except in his own head? Jumping on here. He sat alone in the parking lot and wept until dark, like something was collapsing inside, like I was shrinking. He was apologizing to Patsy as he came through the door, his head going limp on her shoulder. It explained so much, Mrs. Holt said in an interview. For so long it was like he had multiple personalities. One moment he was calm, charming, funny, and then boom, he's angry. It's a huge deal. He's this other person entirely. It was like there were two Joes. The ability to catch one's own mind straying from reality is no small gift. Perhaps half the people with schizophrenia have no such self-awareness, researchers say. Still, it would take years for Mr. Holt to master himself. In the late 1990s, he put himself through a computer programming course and landed a job with a telecom company that looked as if it could turn into a real career. It did not. The company downsized, laying off dozens, including Mr. Holt, who felt that his last best shot at a successful life were gone. After his wife talked him out of suicide in 2000, he took a chance enrolling in a program in marriage and family counseling at nearby Friends University. As part of the preparation to be a therapist, he was encouraged to talk about himself. "I was like a kid in a candy store," he said. "I came on too strong, I think, but at the end of it, for the first time, well, I felt whole." And now we're getting to the meat of it. The question about the impact of a cruel childhood was not the right one, he concluded. There was no answer, and there never would be. It was a distraction. He was hearing voices, he still does, and the only question worth asking was, how does a person live with those? The hardest part is just to stay in the game. I have to scrutinize my every thought, every attitude, every emotion, everything, and ask, is this real? This is the point of this article from why I'm reading it. Suddenly he saw that his involvement with going back and looking why and how, trying to figure this out, trying to figure out his way out of this, was a dead end. And that is a big, big lesson for everyone in this world. We spend a lot of time, years and years, trying to figure out things that we best just dump, leave in the past. And then we ask, how do we handle it now? Not, how did I get here? Why? Or things like that. How do I get out of it? No. He turned his attention to scrutinizing every thought, every attitude, every emotion, everything, and asking, is this real? Interestingly, a spiritual teacher on the West Coast teaches a practice very similar to this. When thoughts come up, she asks, is this true? And somebody might say, my husband's leaving him. I can't stand this. I can't cope without him. I can't live without him. And she asks, is this true? What happens is we take our thoughts to be true. For instance, we look at another person. Maybe that person's in a bad mood and has done some selfish thing. And then we have a concept about that person. Oh, that's a selfish person. We carry this. And the next time we meet this person, the thought comes up. We have this concept. This is a selfish person. And the fact is, we may have been onto something momentarily, but it's only one facet at one time, in one place, of a person. The truth is that people change. And the truth is, in the first place, that that's extraneous, that fundamentally this person is Buddha. And to put a concept on a Buddha and then act on the basis of that concept would be a huge mistake. Actually, the same is true about all conceptualizing. We want to gradually, in Zen practice, we want to diminish our propensity for conceptualizing, analyzing, it doesn't prove, it doesn't lead to anything of truth. We don't see the whole person if we conceptualize that person, put that person in a pigeonhole. We don't experience the whole truth about anything by approaching it with names and conceptualization. We look at a flower or hear a bird. Oh, what's the name of that bird? You've kind of missed it. You've missed, in some degree, you've missed the true experience of hearing that sound. Not to say, however, that it's wrong to learn to know which birds or which songs are associated with what names, what the birds are, what the birds look like. That's not wrong. But fundamentally, we want to be experiencing reality directly, without an intervening concept. And that's what this practice is about. There's only one more sentence I want to read from this article. That's from Joe's wife, Patsy. He says, "I don't have any reference for mental illness except for Joe," she said. "And I tell him it doesn't matter what you've suffered. You're an adult now. You've got to put that aside. You have responsibilities." I tell him everyone struggles with doubts and fears. That's normal. Normal, and I remind him that he has children to help take care of. Now that is great advice. Transcend your own self-involvement with the problem, going beyond, leaving the past in the past. And that's very, very good advice for us here. This is an essential thing to do. And this is what this practice is about, breaking the hold of conditioning on our minds. Conditioning is the past. So now I'd like to get into, in order to fully explain why this relates to Zen practice, I'd like to get into demons and phobias. Now, we dealt there with schizophrenia, and what's true is that very few schizophrenics are able to get as far as Zen practice. A few, and it can help, but then it's a lifelong struggle regardless. A phobia, as it's defined here in Wikipedia, is a type of anxiety disorder, usually defined as a persistent fear of an object or situation in which the sufferer commits to great lengths in avoiding. Wait a minute. A fear of an object or situation in which the sufferer commits to great lengths in avoiding, typically disproportional to the actual danger posed, often being recognized as irrational. In the event, the phobia cannot be avoided entirely, as the sufferer will endure the situation or object with marked distress and significant interference in social or occupational activities. Phobias vary in severity among individuals. Some individuals can simply avoid the subject of their fear and suffer relatively mild anxiety over that fear. Others suffer full-fledged panic attacks with all the associated disabling symptoms. Most individuals understand that they are suffering from an irrational fear, but they are powerless to override their initial panic reaction. So here's a kind of question for you. I don't want you to answer it, but I'll answer it, but I'm still going to ask it. If you meet a demon, a phobia, and that phobia is after you, what is it that the phobia grabs first? The demon. What is it that the demon grabs? Some body part? No. The demon grabs your attention. And ultimately, ultimately, it's the ability to handle your attention which takes care of deep phobias. Not quickly done, but it can be done. I want to read from one of the great, great Zen masters, perhaps the clearest writing I've ever read in Zen. This is from Musō Kokji, a 13th century Japanese Zen master. He was, let me see here. Well, anyway, he was chosen by a lot of emperors, a number 7, I think, because he was such a highly skilled teacher. He was picked to be the national teacher again and again. Musō himself became a highly skilled teacher, producing more than 50 enlightened disciples, a most unusual record. Now, he distinguishes between two types of demons, and I'll read both of the things. This is called demons. There are various mental phenomena and mental postures that obstruct the potential for true understanding. Because of their harmful and destructive nature, they are called demons or devils. These demons include greed, hatred, conceit, opinionated views, addiction to meditation states, pride in knowledge, desire for liberation for one's own sake alone, sentimental compassion, anxious haste to attain enlightenment, idealizing teachers, rejecting the teacher because of finding fault with teacher's external behavior, indulging in passions, and fearing passion. Anyone who wants to realize Buddhist enlightenment is obliged to examine his or her mind and heart for these devils. These demons may arise because of incorrect application of mind. They may also flare up as in a correctly applied mind in which they are about to die out, just as a candle flame will flare up just before it goes out. In any case, do not allow the mind to be stirred by demons, because this agitation perpetuates their influence. And that begins to point to the thing that if you give these things attention, if you give distressing things, phobias, attention, you are actually providing them with energy. The attention is the energy that they live off of. And when we're involved in trying to figure things out, there may be a lot of value in going to a therapist and doing some digging as to what happened in one's childhood and kind of getting rid of some of that anger and that. But ultimately, you need to get your attention off of that in order not to perpetrate their influence, not to perpetuate their influence, not to give them the energy that means that they continue. Now, the other kind of demon is more along the line of phobias. And he writes something about quelling demons. A simple method of quelling demons is to refrain from clinging to anything mentally. This is illustrated by an ancient story in which a strange person used to roam around the grounds of a hermitage of a certain meditation master. Sometimes he would appear as a Buddhist saint, sometimes as a celestial king, sometimes radiating extraordinary light, sometimes uttering strange sayings. This continued for 10 years, and then it stopped. The meditation master told his disciples, "A celestial demon has been coming here to bother me, but no matter what appearance it created, I dealt with it by not looking or listening." The demon's manifestations had an end, but my not looking and not listening have no end. This is it. This is the fundamental practice of Zen. Turning away from demons, from thoughts, from concepts, from even beautiful thoughts, and from sentimental compassion, just turning away. It's not a forced thing. What you have to do to turn away is to redirect your attention. This is it, from counting and following the breaths. It's all about redirecting one's attention, bringing it back to the practice. This undoes the conditioning of mind, whether it involves demons and phobias or whatever. It can't be hurried, but it can't be neglected. Every moment that you're able, you pull yourself out of the thought. The stick does it for you and gives you a little experience of that, but normally you have to do it for yourself. You recognize that you're going off or been off for a long time, and you bring yourself back to the practice. I have one more thing I'd like to read I don't know that this needs to be reinforced, but we'll read this one last thing. This is again by Musso. A primary aim of Zen is the uncovering of what is known as inherent knowledge. This is not the kind of knowledge that is produced by thinking based on conditioned consciousness. It is said that the ignorant are obstructed by ignorance, while intellectuals are obstructed by intellectual knowledge. One way of getting past these obstacles and approaching inherent knowledge is to let go of whatever comes to mind. Whatever. Not this. If you do that, there is a moment of reality before the next thought. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.